This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. What a thrill it is for me today. I have two great authors on. At the bottom of the hour, Hillary Davidson is going to be on, and I'm looking forward to talking to her because I met her first when she was at the Vinoy Hotel at BoucherCon. But I want to start with, this author has been really a part of my reading. When I get all hooked on an author, I just can't stop. And I started reading her because of her first book published in 1996 called Harvest. Tess Gerritsen is an amazing author. Of course, she's an international best-selling author and the author of 12 Rizzolian Isles books, and which, of course, turned into a major series. So I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Tess. Hi, Tess.
Hi, it's good to talk to you, Joy.
Oh, no, my name's Patsy with a Z.
Oh, okay, Patsy with a Z.
Okay, people do that. That's all right. Robin Cook almost did that to me, and Robin Cook was here. He was one of my first guests, and as you know, of course, he wrote Coma. And I when I was young, I worked in a hospital as a candy striper. They don't have them, I think, anymore, you know, with all the rules about, privacy. But it was fun. And so I always was hooked on medical books. Any medical thriller, just I couldn't, you know, resist it. And as I said, way back when you first did Harvest, which is a fantastic book, because, of course, you are a doctor. So yep. It's wonderful that a doctor, you know, as Robin Cook also is a doctor, it's wonderful when you combine the two really fascinating subjects of crime and medicine.
It's, you know, they go together really well.
They do. They
yeah,
do.
Because the crime involves, at least murder mysteries, always involve dead bodies. So, who would know that better than a doctor?
So, and now with the new book, now we don't have, it's not a medical mystery, but we'll get back, I think, to Rizzolian Isles after a while, because I have to ask you, why do people still commit crimes if your show is on the air? They know they're going to get caught. But the new book is called Choose Me, which is a psychological suspense thriller. Very psychological. There's a lot of depth in this book.
Well, we wanted to do a book that would be very, very different in that it would take points of view of various people involved, not just the victim, but also the primary suspect and the police officer. So, in a way, it's a psychological study about not only murder, but also the guilt involved with illicit affairs.
Exactly. Very deep, almost Shakespearean. And when you said we, of course, that's Gary Braver, who you worked with, and it's fascinating that you alternated points of view of the female character and the male character. And I must say that from my point of view, I was really intrigued with Gary's character, Jack Darien, which is the professor in the book. And, of course, you handle the student. So what do you want to tell us about it, without giving away the whole story? But what's your sort of spiel that you like to tell people, as much as you like to tell people?
I like to think of it as, we all are interested in watching train wrecks. So we open up with the train already wrecked. That's the young woman is dead, and that she may have committed suicide or she may have been murdered. And that's the situation our female detective walks into, Detective Frankie Loomis. But she suspects something is very wrong, that this is not just a run-of-the-mill suicide. So we go back in time to see what happened, and what happened was there was an affair between this dead student and her professor, And we follow the affair as it slowly unravels and becomes a complete nightmare. And then we find out exactly what happened. So it's really about an affair between a professor and his student. He's married. He crossed a huge line. And this affair becomes more and more dangerous and more frightening for him anyway. And then it ends in murder.
Well, and I can tell you, we take off from really right from the beginning wanting to know what happened. And, of course, you know, I really, as I said, I like Jack Darien, the professor. I like the way he was created. I was intrigued, of course, with the whole idea of his class, the classes that he set up. And I was thinking, you know, he set up his courses or his main course teaching about eternal lovers. I have to say, as a professor, he had to know that he was going to attract a certain type of person to this class. Just warning here, guys. But I love the way that, you know, Gary handles that. And
That was part of the experiment when we wrote this book. I mean, really, it was an experimental novel for both of us because neither one of us has ever collaborated on a book before. And it began when we were at a cocktail party at Christmas time at a bookstore and talking about the Me Too movement. And we thought it would be interesting to write a book about that type of a situation, but we would have a man write the male point of view and a woman write the female point of view. Because men and women look at things differently. Certainly they would look at this illicit affair differently. So Gary wrote the male chapters starring Jack, the professor, and I wrote both the female detective and the female student. I think Gary had the difficult job. His job was to make this man who had crossed a line, who'd done something he shouldn't have, into somebody we would sympathize with. And that's hard to write a character who's basically a decent person, but has done something terrible. I think the one aspect about this book that may be a little different is that everybody here is flawed. Everybody has done something that they shouldn't have done. And we try to look at human frailty in that regard, that even good people can do bad things, and even bad people may have a streak of goodness in them.
Well, that's where we get very Shakespearean. And I love in this book, you have these two main characters, but I also like very much the detective, the police detective. I thought this was very well done. When I was reading about her, I thought, well, is this going to be another series? That's my first thought. I thought, oh my gosh, she's going to come out. She came out with this wonderful character, and I thought, oh boy, are we headed for another series?
Well, I'm not planning to, but she is a fun character, and I think the reason she's fun is so many of us can identify with her. She's a seasoned homicide detective, but she is also a mother of teenagers. and she's a single mom, and her two girls are brilliant, and so she looks at everything with a mother's eye, and that gives her the superpower of seeing things that maybe other people would miss.
Well, I like her, and I have this feeling we're going to have a spinoff. I'm telling you right now, because if your agents don't say, spin her off, let's do something with this, because she is a wonderful character, and I love the daughters. When I was reading it, and I was, it's so funny, it's about, you know, the Jack has set up this course about lovers, and so we have, you know, Romeo and Juliet and Tristan and Isolde, and of course Aeneid. And I was thinking, oh, it's wonderful in a way that all of this was woven in so cleverly, because now people will actually perhaps read the story, the real books. You know, they'll say, whoa, who is this Tristan guy?
Isn't that funny? Wouldn't you want to take that course? I mean, Gary and I just sort of created this idea of a course about star-crossed lovers because it's the kind of thing that brings a theme to a literature course. People don't just go in and read Tristan and Isolde, for instance. They're going to find out that it's part of an overarching theme of lovers who had tragic ends. very often the tragic end is because the man in the pair was not did not stand up and be as loyal as he should have. We have a lot of stories that end not only tragically but violently with somebody like Medea who commits murder in revenge. So, yeah, it's an overarching look at literature, but at one aspect of literature.
Well, I have a feeling that college universities across the country, you've started something. I think a few professors perhaps tried it before with ulterior motives. I think Jack Darien was really wanting to get people involved in literature, but it works both ways. So and I thought it was so clever, and I just like the idea of people reading the Aeneid for the first time, or trying to read, because I was a Latin student for 4 years in high school. It was my favorite class. And I still remember, you know, translating a great portion of that, from the Latin. So,
wow.
Yeah. So it was, well, my, you know, some of the Latin literature got a little bit too sexual. And so my teacher thought that was a little bit safer, but so it was. It's wonderful, and I do hope that people will say, "Oh, yeah, we have to know more about this, more about who these stories are." And
When I read, it's funny because even before this idea for the book came about, I had just finished reading the Aeneid because I was in Turkey and I wanted to read more about Troy. And I remember when I got to the end of that chapter about Queen Dido and how she commits suicide on her funeral pyre, it is so moving. It's so tragic. I just thought there needs to be a book just about this romance, this tragic romance, this poor queen. And then it ended up being perfect for this story because she becomes a symbol for the young college student, Taryn. She becomes a symbol of how women are abandoned and how you can survive. You can either survive this by fighting back, or you can surrender like Queen Dido.
Yes, so women pay the price when their passions threaten men. That's a quote from your book.
Yeah.
So, yeah. When you were there, did you have the opportunity to see an event where they actually read it in Latin? It's fantastic.
No, I don't. I'm afraid I don't understand.
Well, you actually don't have to understand. When they do it, it's like it's so moving when they do it in Latin. It's quite amazing.
Oh.
I've been to Turkey and Greece, and several times I've managed to see that done, and it's just because of the language, the way that it's, you know, very dramatic. It sends chills up your spine, even though you don't understand all of it. You know, of course, you're given sort of cheat sheets, so you know what's going on. But But I love that you included that, and of course, obsession. Whoa, we're talking obsession, and this is a subject that is, you know, in the news. It's something that people are more and more aware of, stalking and.
Right. And, you know, stalking isn't just done by men. It is also occasionally done by women. And I think we all probably know women who just are right on the edge.
Ooh.
Who, you know, when they break up with somebody that they love and they can't quite let go. And maybe they drive by their ex-lover's house or they find out who he's dating. And so it's not that far-fetched that a young woman like Taryn would exist, especially since she's been abandoned before by both her father and her boyfriend, and the idea of being abandoned for a third time is something she cannot quite handle. And I know a lot of people say, I didn't like this victim, I didn't like Taryn at all. Well, you know, you're not necessarily supposed to like her, but you are supposed to be interested in what she does next.
Yeah, and understand where she's coming from. You know, she's not all evil, you know. So it's. But you're right. There are people like this. I happen to know a few.
Yeah, right.
So I think it's something that will, you know, really intrigue people. It starts off, as I said, right there. You right in the, you know, when you open with it with the main character already dead. You know you have to go somewhere and find out what's happening. So that was just done beautifully. I think the two of you did a great job with it. And I think, well, I know, of course, with you, it's going to be a big hit, a big, you know, best-selling book. Choose Me is the title. And people are going to choose it because it's a great read. And I think I'm finding during this time, I really do appreciate suspense stories even more. Because if they grab me, I can forget about what's the real world. You know, that world, your world is so much better.
Isn't it terrible that my world with murder is better than the real world? But that's, in a way, it's true. We need escape. And I found something very interesting. I mean, right after 9/11, I remember everybody was... they were predicting that romances would come back. We needed escape from 9/11. We needed to go back to soft, you know, soft gauzy literature. And I found out that my serial killer book sold better than ever right after 9/11. And it's because we seek justice. We want to see justice done, and that's what you're going to see in a crime novel.
Exactly. And of course, you did write, I think, 9 romances or something like that, a lot of romances, you know, very successfully until you then, when you eventually were taken over, and perhaps it is true that somewhere, some alien invasion of your mind took place and Rizzoli came into it and took over your life. Unexpectedly, because she wasn't supposed to be a main character, and that's a fun thing about being a writer. You never know which character will really grab you, and Rizzoli did it for you. And the wonderful thing about having a series, of course, every writer dreams of having, you know, their books picked up and made into a movie or made into a series. The wonderful thing about it for you is that 100 years from now, people will still be reading your Rizzoli and Isles books. And this doesn't happen with every author. You can have a bestseller today, but 6 months from now, nobody remembers it, let alone 10 years from now. But when you have a series that's going to play 100 years from now, people are going to be watching Rizzoli and Isles again. Reruns forever.
Well, I hope so. I hope so. I mean, that is the one thing about a series character is that people aren't reading. I find out that people don't really read for plot. They really read for character.
Yes.
They want to follow these people. They become real to them. And that's the power of having a long-running series, whether it's on television or it's a book.
So, I mean, when you think about it, not just your kids are going to benefit from your writing, your grandkids, but your great-great-great-great, you know, like 5 generations down, because even if we move to Mars, people are still going to be watching your series, and then they're going to want to read the book. So,
well, I hope so. I hope so, and I know that there are a number of baby girls who are named Mora because of.
Oh yeah, I know. Yeah. And I do not understand why anybody would commit a crime. I mean, why? When I read, you know, stories about, you know, somebody committed this murder, and I keep saying, don't they watch Rizzoli and Isles and know that Mora is going to figure it out? If it's simply a monkey hair, she's going to figure out who did it.
Well, it is fiction. I mean, the truth is, murder in real life often makes no sense.
Things
have to make sense in fiction, while in real life, nothing makes sense.
Well, I'm hoping to put the scare of Rizzoli and Isles into everybody who's thinking about committing a crime. You're going to get caught. You're going to get caught. Don't do it. I mean, and don't get obsessive. So that's another reason why they should read Choose Me. Learn that obsession is not a good thing.
And the other thing is it's a lesson in how a perfect life can be destroyed with one bad decision.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we focus so much on Jack, the professor, because it's really a story about a good man who goes astray and does everything in his power to try and keep his life together, but he sees it spinning out of control because of this one out of control young woman. What would you do? How far would you go? How desperately would you attempt to save your marriage and your job, and that's the dilemma that Jack finds himself in. And unfortunately, I don't think it's that far-fetched a dilemma for a lot of people.
Yes, which makes me think that perhaps the perfect wedding gift, everybody. We're done with the June wedding. We don't have any June weddings. I don't know when people are having weddings, but if you're giving a wedding gift,
I don't know. It's like,
give this book. Why not? It would be fun because it's like a warning. This could happen to you.
We could pair that with a DVD of Fatal Attraction. That would work.
That would do it. I mean, get your act together, guys. And gals, don't get obsessive about a guy because there are other guys in the world. Really, there are. You don't have to like get too crazy about it. And guys, you can ruin your life with one stupid decision, and ruin your family, ruin your career. There's many reasons why people should read Choose Me.
And be entertained as well.
Of course. Great entertainment. Wonderful entertainment. I think it's it's just very cleverly done, beautifully written by both of you. Of course, I want to say that Gary did a great job. I think he did a great job. And I don't know his academic, he's a teacher, isn't he?
He is a professor. So all those classroom scenes and campus scenes are really taken from his own life.
Ah, okay.
But not the cheating part.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. not the cheating part. We don't want the cheating part. But I have a feeling that, you two make a really great team. It's because it's not easy to do that, to sort of get into the character of both of them so seamlessly that it works.
Yeah, it was a challenge. And in truth, this book took longer to write as a pair than it would for either one of us to have done it separately, just because we were trading chapters back and forth and having discussions about whether the story was going in the right direction. We didn't even know who the killer was until maybe halfway to two-thirds of the way through the story of the first draft. Because it wasn't really clear to us at that point either. So I think that two heads is better than one in terms of, content. But in terms of pulling it all together, sometimes two heads make things complicated.
Well, you guys did a great job. Now, I suppose my listeners would love to hear a little bit about Rizzoli and Isles, the television series, and your relationship with it. And did you go to filmings? Did you take part in it?
I went to the set twice. I was in one of the last shows in the last season. I got to guest star as myself, which was a very interesting experience. But the actual stories themselves were written by their own writing team. I think the only thing that they based their stories on is The Apprentice, which was their pilot episode. That was my book, The Apprentice. And then one of my short stories was turned into an episode where Maura gets arrested for for possibly killing a date. But the rest of it, I have to give them the credit for the writing and also for a lot of the humor. I think they injected a lot of humor into the stories. My books tend to be quite dark.
Yes. But this is what happens when you were, you're picked up. I worked in Hollywood and that's exactly what happens. We used to always joke, "Oh my gosh, when we were working on a something and based on a book, and we'd say, "Oh my gosh, are we going to have the author visit? Let's have the author visit."
I think they probably tend not to want the author to visit because going, "That's what I read, and I didn't write that."
You prepared for it, actually. You prepared for it.
Yeah, I think that writers have to back off when they sell their film rights and realize that now somebody else has taken over their baby and is going to change their baby a little bit.
That's why Sue Grafton, because she worked in Hollywood at the same time that I did, that's why she wouldn't sell her series, the ABC series,
right.
Because she knew what they would do to it, and she just couldn't handle it, having worked in the film industry and worked on scripts of other people's books. She knew what that, you know, often we would take a book and take a, you know, 500-page book and use 120 words out of the whole book, you know. So
that's right. That's adaptation for you. I mean,
that's it. That's it. But it's doing you a great service, of course, making you, well, you were famous before that series because you've had so many wonderful, wonderful books. And I just want to mention one other book, you know. Well, no, I want to go back one more time just to Frankie Loomis, because I think Frankie Loomis is great, and I think you guys should really consider spinning this off. This is another series. Boy, then Gary's great, 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 great grandkids will be benefiting from it. But I do want to mention The Bone Garden, because I love that book. I thought it was terrific.
I love that book, too. It does. It's one of my, I have two historical novels, and that was one of them. And that was very, very medical. It was very based in what medicine used to be. I think it was set in 1820.
Yeah, that's why I loved it, because as I said, I worked in, when I was young, you know, from the time I was 14, I was working in the hospital. And so I was always surrounded by doctors and always, you know, in sort of the medical world, and I love your medical books. They're fantastic. But I wanted particularly to mention that, because that's what happens. You write a book, and you know, that was back in early 2000s, I think, and Nobody talks about it. So I want to mention that one, of course, along with the new book, which is really, it's an obsessive read. How about that? You start reading it, you can't put it down.
Well, that's good. We did our job.
Okay, you did. Well, Tess Gerritsen, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. And my name is Patsy with a Z.
Okay, well, I just have Joy on Paper here in my schedule. Sorry, I got your name wrong.
Okay, well, you just remember it. And perhaps you're not going to BoucherCon, are you?
No, I'm not. Yeah, this year seems to be It's
yeah, no, none of us are going. I don't know anybody who's going. Everybody I've asked, they're not going. But perhaps next year we will meet, and you can remember my name, okay?
I apologize for that, but it'll be great to finally meet you.
Okay, and say hi to Gary, and I will have to have him on the program, and we can talk. I don't know why we didn't book him, too. I will invite him, okay?
Okay, all right, great.
Okay, thank you, Tess. Nice talking to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, we're going to have a commercial, and then we're coming right back with Hillary Davidson. Wow, what a day, what a day.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more rewarding careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
Are you an author? An artist? An inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications, to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Have you ever faced disaster? The Red Cross is always there for you. The Red Cross responds to a call for help every 8 seconds. They have never turned anyone down. Now they need your financial support so that they can be ready to help you when the need arises. Donate online at redcross.org. Thank you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I am back with Hillary Davidson. Whoa, best-selling author of One Small Sacrifice, and her new book is Her Last Breath. Wow, I am so happy to welcome you back to the program, Hillary. How are you?
Oh, doing well, Patsy. Thank you so much for having me back. It's a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, it's always so much fun to talk to you and talk about you, because I was talking about you last week with Larry Block when he was on the program for his birthday. I gave him the entire hour. I don't normally give people the entire hour, but I've started this sort of tradition now. I had Lee Child on for his birthday, and I had him for the entire hour. So,
oh wow, that's a great idea.
Yeah, this is lots of fun because, you know, writers have a lot to talk about, and of course with Larry, well, we're talking a lot to talk about.
Amazing. Oh, my goodness. You could give Larry a day, actually, and just, you know, not be done at all. And it's absolutely fascinating. You blew my mind when you said he mentioned me, because, you know, Larry Block has been a hero, you know, of mine for I can't tell you how many years. I think I started reading him as a teenager. And we've crossed paths, you know, many times since I started publishing books. And it was one of the greatest honors when he asked me to be in one of his anthologies. And so, you know, when you told me what he said about me, it was just like, oh my goodness, to think of like one of these writers that I idolized, you know, enjoying my work too. It just means the world to me. So thank you. Thank you so much for that.
Well, he is wonderful. And of course, the anthologies that he, you know, brilliant anthologies. So it was lots of fun to talk to him. You know, I always, and of course he is a New Yorker. You know, when you think of Larry Block, you think of him as being a New York writer. Like, I think of you as being a New York writer, although you're really Canadian.
Right, and it's almost like a secret identity. So I will admit, I've been in New York now. This is my 20th year in New York City. I married a born and bred New Yorker, and he lured me here, and I actually moved at the worst possible time. I moved in October 2001, which was the time when everybody else seemed to be moving away from the city. And I remember my moving company calling me three different times saying, our records say that you're moving to New York, but that can't be right. You're moving from. And it's like, no, I'm married a New Yorker and I'm still moving there. But it was, you know, in the shadow of 9/11, and the city was, you know, in a really bad place at the time. And so I think there's always this debate about when do you become a real New Yorker. But because I came in at sort of the darkest point in the city and watched the city come back, it's like I have really felt like a New Yorker now for a long time. But, you know, I still have a lot of family in Toronto, you know, family actually in different parts of Canada. And so, you know, that's still like emotional home to me in a lot of ways, too. And I haven't been back there in ages, but I'm looking forward to going back very, very, very soon.
But they have much stricter, I can tell you. I just had a Canadian author on not too long ago, and they were practically under house arrest.
Exactly.
And she had three teenage sons. Let's say.
No, it's like a 2-week quarantine that you have to do, and I'd be able to go because I am a Canadian citizen, but you're right. It is literally like house arrest for 2 weeks.
Yeah. So, but now, of course, I love, you know, the opening chapter in the new book, which is called Her Last Breath. People, it is so wonderful. This first chapter is a New York funeral.
Yes, a very, like a society funeral.
Yes, I love this funeral. I just, you paint such a wonderful picture of it. I felt like I was right there watching these people, looking around at them, having the comments. I thought that was a terrific opening chapter. And I thought after you read that, everybody will just, you can't then stop because you want to know what's going to happen.
That is phenomenal to hear that. It's funny because New York, I think people always think of it as a city with type A personalities and people are very competitive. And it certainly comes out in events. And, you know, with the pandemic last year, we did not have events. But, you know, that changed this year. Things are happening again. You know, whether it's big galas or, you know, big funerals, they are possible to have again. And there's like this pecking order and this sort of sniping at each other and all of these sort of weird politics, even about where people are sitting at a funeral. And it's funny because you get this from the perspective of a character who's grieving, and she's not there for the social pecking order, you know, the sort of social competition. She's there because her sister's died, but she's also a very keen observer. And so, you know, she sees all of this swirling around her, and she wonders about her sister and the life that she married into by marrying into this wealthy family.
Well, so that's the whole story. Now, of course, you know, this idea of a sisters is not new to you. You've used it's something that I think has paid off for you before, because I think your very first book was The Damage Done.
The woman whose sister was missing. Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Everyone always says
to me, what does your sister think about these books? And I always have to say, I don't have a sister. I think I actually was very envious growing up of my girlfriends who had sisters and, you know, that kind of relationship. And I really do feel like my close friends, you know, my best friend, we've known each other since we were 12. A lot of my close friends I've known since we were kids. And I feel kind of like, you know, we are sisters, like we, you know, become sisters with our closeness. But yeah, everyone is always sort of assuming that because I write a lot about these family relationships and especially sisters, that I must have one. But no, I have to admit I don't.
Okay. Well, we hope. Perhaps it's good because the way, oh, poor Caroline Lanzab.
Yes, that's true. Mind you, if I had a sister, people would be wondering about, you know, that relationship. I mean, it's tough because the book, you know, the two sisters, obviously, in some ways, they have a tremendous shared history, know a lot about each other. There is closeness there, but there's also a lot of estrangement and, you know, family problems. And so when Deirdre is at this funeral in chapter one, you know, she's grieving for her sister, but she gets an email that her sister had arranged to go out a week earlier. And in it, her sister tells her things that Deirdre's never heard before, that, you know, her sister's afraid of her husband.
Don't give away too much.
It's chapter one.
Chapter one, I know. They have to read it. I thought, you know, tell us a little bit more about Deirdre, though.
Yeah, well, Deirdre is someone who I would describe as a serious loner. She grew up in a family where physical abuse was not uncommon, and her kind of way of dealing with that has been to retreat from other people. She doesn't trust people. She lives in this sort of, like, grim little apartment, but it's the only place that she can afford to live on her own. Young people in New York, very hard to sort of find a place that you don't have roommates. But she's basically found a really terrible apartment, but, like, it's hers and hers alone, and, you know, that's how she prefers to live. Her mother is dead. Her father is, you know, she hasn't spoken to her father literally in years. And she is very much sort of on the fringes. Like, she's chosen to be on the fringes and to sort of not get close. And it's her sister's death that sort of pulls her into this world that she didn't want to be part of. That as soon as she finds out that her sister's death might not have just been like a terrible sort of medical accident, but actually that, you know, her sister's husband may have had a hand in this, it motivates Deirdre, I would say, to do two things. She wants justice. She wants to get to the truth. But there's a very dark edge in this character, and there's also a side of her that would like to get revenge, would like to balance the scales. And so she becomes really obsessed with getting the truth, but also with the idea of retribution.
Well, for somebody who wanted to stay in the background and not get involved, you catapult her into the action, that's for sure.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit of guilt there. I think, you know, Deirdre herself would absolutely admit that she is, you know, pulled back from these relationships. She's angry at her sister deep down because Deirdre cut off her relationship with her father because her father used to beat her mother, and her sister didn't do that. And part of the tension between the sisters was, why would you talk to this man who used to hit our mother? Like, why would you even still have a relationship with him? Why would you let him be around your young son? You know, there's that sort of, like, family baggage that's tailing along. But I would say that, you know, ultimately then Deirdre feels kind of a guilt that she didn't know these things were going on with
Carolyn. She told Carolyn her problems, and she didn't listen to her sister's problems. So I would say that there's definitely a large helping of guilt that is part of what catapults her, as you said.
And, of course, you tell it with not completely alternating, because it doesn't alternate every chapter, but you tell it in two voices, and you tell it partly in the husband's voice.
Yes, this is one of the trickiest things about the book. So I would say probably something like 70% maybe is from Deirdre's point of view. But early on when I was writing it, I really felt like the husband is this dark, damaged, compelling character. And I think we've all seen a lot of books where, you know, there's a couple behind closed doors, there's secret life going on that nobody knows about, and there's abuse that might happen. And I started thinking, like, what if I actually started to reveal things from his point of view? People are kind of primed to hate him at the beginning of the book because of what Caroline has written about him. But what if I actually let him speak for himself? And it started out as an experiment. I honestly didn't know whether I could sustain it for the book or if it would be too spoilery or, you know, do people really want to read this sort of person who grew up with a lot of privilege, but also a lot of abuse and gaslighting and emotional manipulation and this sort of crazy, crazy family that he grew up in. And it was funny. So it really started as an experiment, but then it snowballed from there because once I started hearing the character's voice, he actually became a bigger and bigger part of the book.
Well, I think it works. Now, what is it with this quote that you were about Wuthering Heights? Where did that come into your mind?
Oh, gosh. So one of the funny things, I think now we're maybe in a little bit of an age where we're reexamining things that used to be popular. And I remember when I was a teenager, people, you know, just becoming obsessed with Wuthering Heights and swooning over Wuthering Heights. And I remember reading it, and I hated that book. I have to admit, I loathed it. And the idea of Heathcliff as this great hero, to me, he just seemed like this unbalanced, unhinged, kind of dangerous person who might turn on you at any time. He didn't seem romantic to me at all. And I was amazed by how many people really sort of felt like this was a great romance. And so the book kind of plays with some of these tropes. The character of Caroline, the dead sister in the book, loved Wuthering Heights, loved the Brontes. Like, this was very much her sort of romantic ideal. And there are these little quotes that pop up in the book. At one point, Deirdre finds some of them when she's searching her sister's room. She finds, like, these little notes that were written on paper. And it's not 100% clear who wrote them, but you get the idea of someone else kind of judging Caroline, judging sort of these things that she liked. And it is actually part of the tension between her and her husband. I would say Theo has the same take on Wuthering Heights that I do, that it's like emotional manipulation and terrible things going on in that book and not romantic at all.
Well, you know, I hated that book too.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that.
Absolutely. I hated that book. I still don't like it. I never liked Heathcliff. I never saw why anybody saw anything in him. Now, I have to...
Exactly.
I mean, the two of them, I had no patience for either one of them, to tell you the truth. I thought they were both awful.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, I moved to England when I was 21 years old and bought a 400-year-old cottage there because I wanted to live near where Jane Austen was born, because I was obsessed with Jane Austen at a young age. And I wanted to be near where she was born. And it was really great for me. But I'm glad that I didn't like Wuthering Heights and landed up there.
No, it's funny. I love Austen, and I feel like, talk about a keen social observer. Like, what she would have made of the funeral in chapter one, you know, she's just like a very cutting kind of eye and so perceptive. But I'm glad to hear you say that. I think that there's maybe a little bit more of a conversation now around these books that were popular and kind of the really unhealthy ideas that, you know, were present in them, but that end up forming young people's notions of what's romantic and how unhealthy some of these ideas that we're carrying around. It's not to blame a particular book, but if, you know, society treats it as like this is the ultimate romance and Hollywood has made multiple versions of Wuthering Heights as this great romance and...
What do you think about Jane Eyre?
Oh, I actually really enjoyed Jane Eyre. To me, it's a really dark book. I loved the book. I was fascinated by it. I still am. It's been a while since I reread it, but it is so horrifically dark to me. The ending kind of has never really sat very well with me. But I would say, like, the book itself, I loved the character of Jane Eyre herself.
Me too. I love that book. Have you listened to the Audible version?
No.
It is so good, the Audible version. I listened to it twice during this pandemic year when I really needed something to take my mind off of everything else. The Audible version of Jane Eyre is terrific. You really should listen to it. You'll really... And then I went back and read the book again. You know, I always have to have it sort of both, but the Audible version is terrific. And I much prefer Rochester.
Oh, I know. I mean, definitely compared to Heathcliff. So I will say that it's funny. One of the things that I said, like, never sat well with me, this idea of, like, you know, the mad woman in the attic. And there was a terrific essay last week by Joyce Vance. It was right after the Britney Spears hearing. And it was about this sort of tradition of, and mostly in real life she was writing about, but writing off women as mad women and locking them up. And apparently Charles Dickens actually tried to do that in real life with his wife after she'd given him, you know, 9 or 10 children. He wanted to take up with a younger woman, so he tried to get her declared mad. And I was just watching a biography of Cary Grant, and his mother disappeared when he was a young child. He thought that she'd left him, but his father had actually had his mother committed to a mental institution, and he didn't know for 30 years that that was what had happened to her. And then, like, he literally, like, found her 30 years later, still alive, still in a mental institution. So it's funny. Like, I wrestle with that side of it. You know, Rochester in some ways seems like a great character, and then you're also looking at it from the point of view of, like, you know, the mad woman in the attic. And I think that's, you know, there's this fascinating kind of body of literature that's emerged from that. Like, tell me the perspective of the mad woman in the attic. Is she actually crazy, or is she just doing and saying, you know, inconvenient things?
Well, you like to do mad people in attics.
Yes.
And, you sort of have this dark side of you.
That is true. Absolutely. I think I relate to that. I always think about the people that society writes off. But, you know, are they being written off just because they're too inconvenient for other people around? Are they saying things that other people don't want to hear? You know, what's the reason? Why are they being rejected and sort of in this punitive way?
Well, I think that Her Last Breath is a great read. And Hillary, it's always so wonderful to have you on, and hopefully one day I'll get to New York, and it'd be so nice to see you.
It's always a pleasure to speak with you, and I'm so glad that you enjoyed the book. It's my first standalone in quite a few years. I've only done 2 standalone books. Most of my books are series, and so it felt like a real departure, and that, you know, anything can happen.
Exactly.
You know, it's exciting to do that.
Well, do you have a website where people can see you?
I do. I'm online at hillarydavidson.com, so just my name.com, and you can find me there. There's some video on there. I've been doing some events around the book. You can read an excerpt of the book. Come visit me at hillarydavidson.com.
Okay. Well, Hillary, thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper today. And again, it's just... The name of the book is Her Last Breath, and it is available online, and I'm sure in bookstores. Bookstores are opening again, we hope. We hope so. And again,
Definitely. Thank
you so much for being on Joy on Paper. You are always such a joy, Hillary.
Oh, thank you so much, Patsy. It's always lovely to talk to you because you always, you know, you don't just read the book once. Sometimes you've read it multiple times. It's always, like, you know, lovely that you're able to sort of zero in on these different things. It's exciting to talk to you because of that.
Well, thank you so much. Okay, bye-bye now. I hope New York gets better.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Oh, she is so nice. Oh, she's so lovely. And I, you know, as I said, suspense books right now are the ones that are keeping my mind occupied, other than some, I actually got a funny book yesterday, and I'm going to be telling you about that, and I'm going to have the author on, and it's a funny book. A Writer Prepares by Lawrence Block, and he was on last week for his birthday. It's called A Writer Prepares. That is also a laugh-out-loud funny book. It's his memoir about his younger days in New York back in the 50s when he first started writing. And it's one of the few books that I've had this year where I'm reading along. You know, it's of course, it's always inspirational to hear how a writer, becomes a writer, becomes a famous writer. But he has a lot of snippets, a little sort of gossipy kind of things in there. And I found myself laughing out loud, which is, goodness gracious, a rare experience nowadays with so many of the books I get, because I do get a lot. I love suspense books, but I don't want any really creepy books. I think I mentioned before that I've got two leprosy books, and I actually I put them down in the laundry room. We have a laundry room where people put books, and I don't usually put books because, of course, all of the books I get are first edition, so I'm not going to go putting them in any laundry room. But I actually put those two books. I could not put them in the garbage. I just can't do that. It's like impossible for me to put them in the garbage. But I put them in the laundry room, and there's a few people in the building that annoy me anyway, and I'm hoping they pick them up and read about leprosy. Oh, this world is getting crazy. And next week, I'm going to have some more literary gems from Jim Lamb, and we're going to start having those frequently and also putting them up online. So I'm going to have a little section on my webpage just for Jim Lamb and his literary gems, and we're going to be having those starting next week. And more book buzzes from Rita Moreau. She's done some really great ones, including one for John Gilstrap. It was so wonderful to have him on the program this week. And of course, Devon Miller, another great selection, his July selection. And this guy is just brilliant at selecting wonderful, wonderful authors for children. So I will have all of that next week. Wow, it's hard to believe it is Thursday, right, Ed? It is Thursday. Yeah, Ed's not. I don't know. I mean, I told John Gilstrap it was July, so who knows? Anything can happen here. Maybe everybody's watching that show. What's that one? The one now that Back in Time or something. Anyway, everybody, remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel. You never know, and you won't unless you start writing. And it can happen for you, and I'm hoping it's going to happen for Carol J. Perry, because not only does she have the Witch City Mysteries, she's got a whole new series coming out, and we're going to be talking a lot about that next week. But I'm running out of time, so I'm going to say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Thank you, Ed. Thank you so much. He's saluting me, and I'm saluting him. Oh, wow. Everybody, it's just been a wonderful, wonderful time, a wonderful day. Everybody, have a great weekend. Bye-bye now.